at 89.3 FM. This is member-supported WPFW, Washington.
Tuesday, April 29th, I'm Jana Parker, joined by my co-host, Dave Rabin. Good morning to our community watch and comment listeners. You can call us right now at 202-588-0893. And today we're joined by Rebecca Rindell, who heads S&H for the AFL-CIO. She'll tell us more about that. And Jordan Barab, former assistant head of OSHA, Occupational Safety and Health Administration. Later on in the show, Dave will speak with Ruth Conniff, editor-in-chief of the Wisconsin Examiner, about the FBI's recent arrest of a Wisconsin judge who's accused of shielding an immigrant from a federal agent. And later on, Dave will also be joined by Kiana Johnson, founder of Life After Release, a formerly incarcerated Black woman-led organization striving to build a post-conviction movement, challenging the conviction system in the DMV and ensuring that formerly incarcerated individuals and persons get what they need to succeed. Now, on with the show. Rebecca, thank you for joining us today. Can you tell us a little bit about yourself and then also kind of explain S&H to us? And then let's go into some more questions.
Sure, happy to be here. Thank you so much for inviting me. I am the Safety and Health Director, the Safety and Health Policy Director at the National AFL-CIO. So we are the American Federation of Labor, Congress of Industrial Organizations, a nice long acronym for everybody. We have 63 national union affiliates across the country, and they overlap into Canada. And we have combined about 15 million union workers under our umbrella. So that is the work that we do at the national level.
That's awesome. That's awesome. So as we're in May and we're coming up on this particular holiday, what are the origins of the Workers' Memorial Day?
Sure. Workers' Memorial Day was started in 1992 in the U.S. and some other countries have been commemorating it around the same time and years before that. And Workers' Memorial Day is April 28th of each year. So it was actually yesterday. And it is a time that we remember workers who have died on the job, and we know that is mostly from preventable causes, and we recommit to improving workplace conditions and to improving laws and to improving workplace policies so that we don't have families who lose people every day to work. Right now, an estimated 385 workers die in the U.S. each day from a work-related cause. That includes both the workers who die from traumatic injury on the job and also those who die from chronic occupational disease. So Workers' Memorial Day is all about recommitting, calling people together to do better and to fight for better working conditions.
I know that happened about 54 years ago. And so just how much progress have we made in this field during this time?
Sure, the OSHA Act, the Occupational Safety and Health Act, and the MSHA Act, the Mining Safety and Health Act, were created roughly 50 years ago by Congress, bipartisan, and under different administrations to set nationwide standards and enforcement for improving those conditions on the job. And so those have fluctuated over the years, but these statutes were created for a strong call for our nation to tackle this problem in a national way. And we've been releasing at the AFL-CIO something called the Death on the Job Report every year. It's called Death on the Job, the Toll of Neglect. And we issue this. It's a 200 to 300 page report now, and it covers a variety of issues. And essentially we release this around Workers' Memorial Day every year to call attention to the current national state of working conditions and those who are dying and being injured and made ill because of their work, and also a state-by-state profile of how that's going in each state. So we did just release that report last year last week in preparation for Workers' Memorial Day. And this is the 34th year of the report, so that we can have one place for our nation to track how we're doing and how we need to do better.
What were the major findings of this year's report? Like, how many workers were killed or injured on the job each year, but specifically with this report?
Sure. This report covers worker fatality data from 2023, because that's the most recent data available out of the Bureau of Labor Statistics. And they found that 5,283 workers were counted as dying of work-related disease in 2023. And the best literature on chronic occupational disease show that roughly 135,000 die each year from diseases that are made because of their job. And so that is how we say that 385 workers still die on the job each day, because a combination of those numbers divided by the day of the year. And, you know, the job fatality rate is still high. It went down from the year before that, but what you're seeing is still elevated rates among workers of color, Black workers, Latino workers, higher job fatality rates. We're still seeing massive injury rates. 3.2 million workers died of, had work-related injuries or illnesses. And we see some extremely high job fatality rates in different states, in Wyoming, West Virginia, Arkansas, Alaska, Montana. And really, this report doesn't just look at those data, which I know are hard to hear for some people, but we really also look at how our job and safety enforcement agencies are enforcing what's going on in the workplace and what their penalties are. So we found that the average penalty in fiscal 24, which was recently, was still only $4,000 for violating the OSHA Act. For a serious violation of the OSHA Act, is $4,000 per violation. And the average penalty for our OSHA state plans was only $2,500. And then I just wanted to say that the median penalty for killing a worker we found to be only $16,000 for a company for when a worker dies on the job and the company is found in violation of doing that. So it only costs them a median of $16,000. And we still have few cases that are criminally prosecuted. So we have we do track this information to show that these metrics are still too low to be a deterrent for employers who aren't following the laws that were created 50 years ago that you were talking about. And in addition to that, we have fewer inspectors than we used to have with a growing workforce. And OSHA's current budget only amounts to $3.92 available to protect each worker on the job. Their budget has been flatlined and essentially decreased with inflation over the years.
Oh, wow. Okay. I think you touched on like kind of some of the next question I was going to ask in context. So like, what are the major health and safety problems that still need to be addressed? And then just kind of like, OSHA only has enough inspectors to inspect each workplace once every 189 years. Mm-hmm. I mean, how could OSHA utilize its limited resources better? How can they squeeze a dollar out of 15 cents?
Right. Well, so Congress appropriates the budget to OSHA and to MSHA and to NIOSH, which I hope we talk about. But, you know, it's Congress's role to allocate these agencies more money. And we do call on Congress to do that. These job safety agency budgets have been, you know, flatlined for years. We need to increase the enforcement staff, also the staff who set standards, which I know is, you know, it's hard to talk about right now, especially, you know, not to be tone deaf as to what's going on here. We're in the national landscape. We've been calling for an increase in staffing and funding to fully get these agencies to be able to do their job, to reach more workplaces, to make sure folks are following the law. But right now, what we're seeing, of course, across the country is a cutting of the very federal workers who do that.
Yeah, and that's so... Can you explain to like our listeners why OSHA is important, not just outside of the capacity of protecting workers, but how protecting workers protects the community at large?
Sure. You know, often often workplace offenders who, you know, have let's say a chemical problems, right? Those chemical exposures tend to be both in the workplace and what we call in the fence line community. So people who live around those workplaces are also at risk of the results of chemical exposures, but also any workers who are put at risk on the job, you know, make the workplace, the working conditions unsafe for everyone. So right now there's a lot of division among types of people and who deserve what. And, you know, when you put some workers at risk, everyone's at risk. You need to make sure that we have systemic protections so that they raise the floor for everyone so that everyone can receive those protections on the job. And, you know, people are going to work because they need a paycheck. They don't go to work to die. They go to work to bring food home for their families. And when workers are injured on the job or they die on the job, families, society, the healthcare system, everyone else pays the cost and pays the price. So it's extremely important both for the dignity of work, but also for, you know, making sure that people are returning home to their communities. And Jordan actually, you know, he headed OSHA and was the assistant over at OSHA, head of OSHA. So he might want to say a little bit more about all the great work that OSHA does.
Great transition.
Thanks, Rebecca. Yeah, Gina, a couple things, you know, going back to some of the things you were talking to Rebecca about. First of all, in terms of the impact of workplace injuries, illnesses, and deaths on society in general, as you know, this country is undergoing an opioid epidemic, and a lot of the opioid cases come from, you know, workers who get addicted to drugs because of the painful aftermath of injuries they suffered on the job, musculoskeletal injuries, back injuries, shoulders, wrists, that type of thing. And that, you know, leads to basically to having to take drugs to deal with those injuries and then, you know, becoming addicted to drugs. We focus a lot on the number of workers who are killed in the workplace and justifiably so. But there are millions of workers who are injured in the workplace every year, and we kind of forget about them. But many of them end up suffering, you know, very painful injuries for the rest of their lives, and they aren't able to work anymore, which obviously has an impact on the economy as well as the effects on their family. One other thing I just wanted to mention, because you asked how, you know, a small agency like OSHA can, you know, expand its effect given its low budget. You know, one thing we tried to do when I was at OSHA is make this very small agency seem bigger than it was. One way you do that is to issue higher penalties. You know, OSHA's penalties are relatively limited by Congress in terms of their maximums, but OSHA has the ability to, by combining penalties and by issuing severe violations, of increasing those penalties and publicizing those penalties and publicizing the preventable deaths of workers. And by publicizing that and by issuing large penalties, you send a message really across the country, not only in the specific geographic area where the OSHA violations have occurred, but throughout the industry, with you know, where the workers were injured or killed. And you send a message out there that OSHA is on the job, you know, that OSHA will come and inspect, especially if you injure or kill someone, and that, you know, penalties will be issued. Now, you know, we know, again, that OSHA is, you know, very limited in terms of staffing, very limited in terms of the amount of penalties you can issue. But nevertheless, you can, you know, use those to really make the organization look bigger than it is. And unfortunately, those are the areas that Republicans in general and the Trump administration specifically have gone after. They've issued very few press releases about the citations they've issued. Generally, what you see, we're not, you know, it's still early, but, you know, generally what you see is much lower penalties in Republican administrations than you see in Democratic administrations. And the message is therefore sent out to employers across the country that they don't really have to worry about any kind of health and safety enforcement, and they're free to do what they want. They're free to cut corners as much as they want on workplace safety.
Yeah, I mean, that goes into what my next question in regards for what is happening now to OSHA and NIOSH under the Trump administration. And callers, you can call in at 202-588-0893. That's 202-588-0893. So yes, Jordan, what is happening right now that you're seeing under the Trump administration?
Okay, well, I mean, right now we've been, you know, Rebecca can go into this in much more detail, but we've seen basically the elimination of NIOSH, the National Institute for Occupational Safety and Health, which does a number of things. I mean, they do research. They were congressionally created in the Department of Health and Human Services to do research around health and safety issues, to issue recommendations around health and safety issues, to certify respirators. They do great work in terms of protecting and treating mine workers who are suffering from black lung disease. They fund universities around the country to really create the pipeline for health and safety professionals around the country. They are a very small organization that no one has ever heard of, but they provide an enormous contribution to ensuring that workers are safe around the country. OSHA, you know, the hammer has not come down on OSHA yet. We are hearing that, you know, offices may be closed around the country, which would severely inhibit OSHA's ability to get to workplaces. Due to the early retirements, OSHA's lost about 10% of its already much too small staff, which will again impede OSHA's ability to enforce the law. We still haven't seen yet whether OSHA is going to suffer severe layoffs, as many other federal government agencies have. We will see as things go on. We will also most likely see a cessation in progress on any new OSHA standards. OSHA is working on a standard on heat to protect workers against heat, to protect workers against infectious diseases, workplace violence. This administration has basically said that they want to repeal regulations as opposed to issuing new ones. And if they issue any new ones, they need to withdraw 10 existing regulations and standards. So we're not expecting much progress, certainly in protecting workers from new and unregulated hazards in this country. And we may have quite a fight on our hands to maintain, the very limited resources that OSHA already has.
This is so sad and so horrible to hear. Is there anything being done to fight these cuts?
So I'll just I'll jump in a little bit here because we're taking a lot of action as it relates to NIOSH at the moment. I mean, Jordan gave a good background of what's going on at NIOSH, but you know, NIOSH is a absolutely critical safety and health agency. OSHA and MSHA cannot do NIOSH's job. I mean, we sort of, you know, think about how folks right now are looking at, you know, redundancy in the government and thinking, and it's like totally without context to say that OSHA and MSHA are even, you know, statutorily able to do NIOSH's job. NIOSH performs all these critical functions and the agency as a whole works together. So, you know, I know that there are different programs that go on at NIOSH for like mining and for firefighting and for the World Trade Center Health Program and the Energy Workers Program, which helps take care of these workers who have been made ill over the years because of different events, but they can't really operate without the rest of the agency. So we're calling on Congress and, Secretary of HHS, RFK, and President Trump to restore these cuts to NIOSH, restore the staff, reinstate the staff, restore the agency and the programs. They're also critical to work together to actually do the function of the agency and for each division to really perform its function. Jordan mentioned it's a tiny agency. I think, you know, the number I mentioned earlier, that OSHA has $3.92 per worker. If you look at NIOSH's budget, they have like $2.20 per worker. So it's a highly efficient agency and they do an incredible amount of work. This is where all your experts lie, your occupational physicians, your industrial hygienists, your epidemiologists, all these people that know in and out how to, you know, review claims by workers who are affected by chronic occupational disease, et cetera. And so we have a call to action. The AFL-CIO has an action alert to call members of Congress. We have to tell every member of Congress how much NIOSH means to us. And what we had seen was that the HHS cuts were done with artificial intelligence. And so they reorganized HHS using AI. And what that essentially did was cut out this critical worker health and safety agency that cannot be done, the roles cannot be done anywhere else. And so we're saying, which is true, this was a mistake and it needs to be reversed. Everything needs to be restored. These critical programs literally save people's lives every day. And we need to reverse, this mistake.
No, agreed. And just my final question, about half of the states have their own state-run OSHA programs. Are there opportunities to make progress on the state level as we're seeing this national attack?
Yeah, there definitely is. As you say, about half the states have their own OSHA programs, and roughly half of those are controlled by Democratic governors or legislatures. And we've seen them make a lot of progress in areas where OSHA hasn't been able to. There are about half a dozen states now, including Maryland, for example, that have heat standards, which federal OSHA does not yet have and is unlikely to have in the near future. California, for example, has an ergonomic standard, an infectious disease standard, a workplace violence standard that federal OSHA doesn't have. So we can see progress in those states. Unfortunately, it's a relatively small handful of states, but we can definitely see progress in those states moving forward and protecting workers and hopefully setting an example for workers in the other states and around the country to organize both on their state levels and on the federal level for better protections.
Thank you. I just want to thank you guys so much for joining us. Again, we just finished up talking to Rebecca Rendell from the AFL-CIO, as well as Jordan Barab, the former assistant head of OSHA, Occupational Safety and Health Administration. Just want to have everyone know that you can call in and ask questions in our community watch and comment. The phone number is 202-588-0893. That is 202-588-0893. Just to let you know what's coming up next in the show, the next half hour, Dave will be speaking to Ruth Conniff, an editor-in-chief of the Wisconsin Examiner, about the FBI's arrest of a Wisconsin judge. She's accused the judge of shielding an immigrant from federal agents. And Dave will be talking to Kiana Johnson, founder of Life After Release, this wonderful organization is led by a formerly incarcerated Black woman, and it's an organization striving to build a post-conviction movement challenging the conviction system in the DMV and ensuring that formerly incarcerated persons get what they need to succeed. Now I'm going to pass it on to Dave.
Thank you, Jana. Appreciate it. Hannah Dugan, a judge on the Milwaukee County Circuit Court, was arrested on Friday over allegedly helping an undocumented immigrant, FBI Director Kash Patel said, evade arrest the week prior. U.S. Attorney General Pam Bondi quickly jumped on Fox TV attacking Judge Dugan. The Trump administration is apparently attempting to intimidate the judiciary, the only branch of government left to counter Trump, given the current complacency of Congress. I mean, so much for checks and balances. I don't think President Trump has a conception of what that is. But what's it like on the ground in Wisconsin? We're joined now by Ruth Conniff, editor-in-chief of the Wisconsin Examiner. Ruth Conniff, thank you so much for joining us here on Community Watch and Comment.
Happy to be here.
It's great to have you. So what's the mood in Wisconsin, the Badger State, with a long-term and well-respected judge pictured in handcuffs?
It was shocking. I mean, on Friday morning when this happened, it was just a bombshell. There have been concerns about ICE raids. This is the third ICE raid inside the Milwaukee County Courthouse in this new Trump administration. And there's been a lot of concern expressed by the mayor of Milwaukee, the county executive, members of the legislature, other local officials, about the fact that it has a chilling effect. If people can't show up to a hearing on any issue without being afraid that they'll be snatched and deported, it has a real chilling effect on the system of justice and due process of law, you know, across the board. And that, so that's been an ongoing sore point in Milwaukee, where there've been massive protests outside the courthouse against these previous ICE raids. And the judges there have been pretty prickly about having their space invaded. You know, the judge is in charge in a courtroom. They have a lot of authority. They're trying to run proceedings there in an orderly fashion. And in this case, a week before the arrest, you know, this judge was having court with this Mexican immigrant on a completely unrelated to immigration misdemeanor charge. And these ununiformed federal agents showed up outside the courtroom and announced that they were going to come in and grab this guy. And the judge was, if you read the criminal complaint, one of the things they appear to be charging her with is being an angry judge and trying to retain control of her courtroom.
Well, that's a crime, being an angry judge.
And I mean, very and completely unheard of. You've never seen a stern word from a judge, I'm sure, before. So she came out in the hall and she told them no, they could not invade her courtroom. She demanded to see the warrant that they had. They did not have a sufficient warrant. They had what's called an administrative warrant, which means that somebody back at the office had signed the warrant. They had not gone through their normal process, go to a judge, go to a grand jury, and establish sufficient grounds to deport this guy. So they really had no right to be there, and they were very disruptive. So what the judge did, and what is the basis for these felony charges, is she told the man and his lawyer to leave out a side door of the court. And the important thing to know about the fact that they left out the side door is that they went into the same space where the federal agents were standing. They saw this guy walk past them in the hallway. One of those agents got on the elevator with him as he went down. They chose not to make an arrest and grab him until he was outside the courtroom. But in no way did the judge's actions impede that. So the case that they have against her is just, as one lawyer who our reporter Henry Redman interviewed, a former federal prosecutor, a bunch of crap. It's just not, it's a ridiculous, and of course, as you pointed out at the beginning, we have the highest level law enforcement agents in the country going on Fox News to talk about this immediately, completely ruining the normal process of going to a grand jury that can establish this person, you know, the reasonableness of these charges. So it's just a really messed up process. And the kicker is that what shows it's just a completely political and not legal act. They put her in handcuffs and ankle manacles as if she were a flight risk and a serious danger to society in order to bring her into the courtroom to make these charges. So, you know, it's grotesque. It is a huge play for publicity. We spent all day at the Examiner covering this on Friday, covering what was happening on the ground in Milwaukee, at the courthouse, talking to legal experts. And by the end of the day, I felt like I had been had. I mean, this is a Fox News story. That is the point of this arrest. It is not because, as they claimed, it was a huge public safety concern. You know, it's like the chant in 2016, lock her up. The idea of grabbing this woman who had some authority, humiliating her, undermining her, and threatening her with these felony charges is just a big thrill for the MAGA base and a real publicity stunt for the Trump administration, but completely without any basis in the law.
I mean, I'm trying to think, is there, can you think of any example of a judge being arrested like this? I can't think of one.
No,
I mean, I've been around for a while, It's really quite bizarre in a state that voted for Trump, right?
Yeah. Yep. Wisconsin helped put Trump over the top in 2024.
Yeah. Right. And you've been on the national radar with the election with the recent election of the Supreme Court judge.
Well, and so interestingly, that was another liberal woman judge. Her opponent, who is a right-wing Republican operative, received enormous support from Elon Musk, who came to the state and offered voters cash prizes to register and vote for him. And so here's this, you know, woman judge who won in that case. And here's a case where the Trump administration is exacting its revenge, as Trump has openly declared he plans to do with the federal law enforcement system at his disposal, by trying to humiliate and intimidate another liberal woman judge in a liberal city, Milwaukee, where, you know, people did not vote for Donald Trump, and to try to drive home, we have the power and we can scare you. We can lock you up.
Yeah. So we need to, unfortunately, we could go on. I mean, it's such a bizarre case, but what do you think's likely to happen with the judge's case?
I mean, I think it's really awful for her. I don't think that these charges will stick. You know, the statewide board is taking a look at whether there's an ethics problem with the judge. I think in the end, she'll be cleared of all of this, but it does some lasting damage.
Yeah, I mean, it's just, it's quite bizarre, but, you know, I mean, unending stream of bizarreness coming out of this administration. It's, you know, her jumping on the Attorney General, Pam Bondi, jumping, you know, almost immediately onto Fox. I mean, it's clearly a showcase for them. You know, they don't care about, I mean, it's, I was looking up the definition of sociopathology and this administration and Mr. Trump fit the bill. I mean, they don't care about people. It's all about, getting to the end game.
Well, hopefully it'll give people pause to see how destructive and careless they really are.
Yeah. Ruth Conniff, editor-in-chief of the Wisconsin Examiner, really great having you. Thank you so much for all you do and for joining us today.
Yeah, great to be here. Thanks, David.
Great having you. And on with our last guest, Keanna Johnson is the founder of Life After Release, a formerly incarcerated Black woman-led organization striving to build a movement to change the inequitable systems that create a cycle of policing, supervision, and incarceration in the DMV. Keanna Johnson, welcome to Community Watch and Comment. It's great to have you.
Oh, good. Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate being here.
And, my hearing is less than stellar. If you could get on camera, it's not being broadcast, but I'm doing more lip reading than I care admit. If you can alter that. Thank you. There you are with your wonderful shades on. I love it.
Thank you.
And we would really like to hear from callers, particularly if you have any experience with incarceration that we're going to be talking about today. 202-588-0893. 202-588-0893. We'd really like to hear from you all. Keanna Johnson, how did Life After Release get created?
Yes, Life After Release was created shortly after I came home from prison in 2017. We started as a just a support group for individuals who are returning home in a resume clinic in 2017, working inside of the library once a month. And we kind of morphed into what we are today and developing individuals who are change leaders and changing different legislations and different things that impact the quality of life for those who are returning home. Because what we realized was it was more necessary than just getting a job for our people who are returning home. but it is also a quality of life issue that individuals who are returning home often don't have, a quality of life that a lot of the times are really worth living. And I say that with a sad heart, but it's true. You know, in some places you can't vote, in some places you can't sit in a jury box, in a lot of places you can't get a job, in other places you can't go to school. Sometimes you can't get a driver's license. So it is a very limited quality of life that individuals have, even down to like just having normal food when you're inside, coming home, having access to food on the outside. So it's a plethora of issues that are intersected to those who are returning home.
Yeah, I mean, it's quite an experience that a lot of us, you know, I mean, I would say the majority of people haven't had, and it's really important to understand. I mean, talk about, you know, I mean, one of the things that you touched on, I believe, is, you know, what the prison conditions were like. I mean, it was, is that something that you continue to highlight and advocate for?
Absolutely. You know, one of our latest and longest standing local campaign is how we address the food in the jails. You know, just because someone is incarcerated, we work very closely with the Food Coalition in Prince George's County, PG Changemakers, and legislators to be able to identify the fact that individuals who are incarcerated need to have adequate and healthy foods, starting with, you know, pregnant women having adequate foods and being able to have specified diets. We saw this during the insurrection when there were folks who were incarcerated and they were looking for a vegan diet. You know, the way people eat their food is very paramount to how they live their life.
Yep. Very important. We'd love to hear from callers, as I said, 202-588-0893, particularly if you have a similar experience, but any questions, comments that you might have, 202-588-0893. Kiana Johnson, talk about what it was like when you were released. I mean, difficulty getting work, difficulty getting housing. What was it like?
Well, before my incarceration, I did have college education. I had I was a government employee, and I had certain privileges and accesses in education upon going in. So when I came out, for myself particularly, it was not necessarily hard to, you know, get a job, but it was hard to identify resources. You know, when I came home, we have in Prince George's County, we have a center called the Adams Center at the time, and that was kind of like the go-to resource center. However, it was not very helpful to me. And one of the good things that I can report today is that now we're in partnership with the county to be able to expand the reach of what is now known as the Bridge Center, and partly based on my experiences of coming home and not being able to receive much support. I don't think that is necessarily on purpose. The way that the reentry support is administered in a lot of places. I just think that it's because there isn't a lot of intentional resources and people who are impacted by the system actually being in position to make those changes. And I think that Prince George's County is well on their way to starting to implement some of those things in our county.
It's good to hear. We have a caller. Thank you so much for calling in. Your name, where you're calling from, if you care to disclose it, and your question or comment. Are you with us? I'm not hearing you.
Can you hear me now?
I can hear you now. Thanks for calling in.
Hi. Thank you for the opportunity. My name is Charles. I'm calling from Southeast Washington, D.C. I was formerly incarcerated. I was released in 89, and fortunately, haven't been back since. But and I'd just like to commend your guest for the work she does, and I believe those things ID, housing, job, all the things that they'll need to get a running start when they're released. I believe the system itself, you know, not to put down the work she does, certainly, but in any way, rather. But I just think the state needs to provide those while or in the person's, I guess, the last 6 months or year or so of release, however long providing those things might take. But one question I'd like to ask, from my experience, I've learned that prosecutions in the D.C. Superior Court are done by the United States Attorney. And the prosecution is in the name of the United States Attorney General, or prosecuted by the United States Attorney General. And that process, particularly in the Superior Court, I found denies you due process in that the judges, being non-tenured and non-U.S. judges, that is, they don't have salary and tenure protections, which allow them to render their decisions independently of the political climate that may be, you know, in place. But also, in those trials, you lose your constitutional right to the writ of habeas corpus, in that once you're convicted in the Superior Court, you cannot, like all others, including those, I understand, at Guantanamo now, can file to the federal courts, the United States courts, for a writ of habeas corpus. You have to go through this kind of local process, and I understand some of that is important, but the constitutional right to the writ of habeas corpus is denied, and to my knowledge, we are, those who are convicted in Superior Court, are the only persons detained in the United States, save immigrants, non-citizens maybe, who lose their constitutional right to the writ of habeas corpus, that is, to after they've exhausted that state process, right, can go to the United States District Courts for a petition for a writ of habeas corpus. And I think that denies us the equal protection of the laws. And there's a prior, I believe, case here by an in-bank panel of the United States District Court in Palmore versus the D.C. Superior Court, in which the panel ruled just that. Unfortunately, yes, that case, combined with another case, was reversed, and the only the issue in the other case, not the Palmore case, that is the equal protection and the suspension of the writ.
I got you. I want to get our guest's response to your important question. Yes. Kiana Johnson, your thoughts, please.
Absolutely. And this is a very important topic that you're mentioning. Actually, I'm a co-founder at Harriet's Wildest Dreams. I don't know how many people on the call have actually heard of this organization. And so we do a lot of work in the DC area. And one of the things that we do at Harriet's Wildest Dreams is we do something called participatory defense. And being as though what you're talking about is more so of a statehood issue. And so there are a lot of coalitions that are in place. One of them that Harriet's Wildest Dreams is a founding member of is the Free DC campaign. Charles, I don't know if you've heard of Free DC. However, it is a very active group of people from the community in Washington, D.C. that is actively organizing to against the issues, very issues that you're raising right now. The only way that those, and it's very important because right now, even more so, DC's home rule is under attack. The current administration has made it very clear that they would like to remove home rule that has been standing since the 70s and remove that from DC. And more than just writ of habeas corpus will be impacted if our DC home rule is removed. So as a DC resident, I encourage you to get connected to Free DC and other coalitions that are fighting not only for statehood, but for the immediate attack of home rule that is under attack right now in Washington, D.C. It's one thing for us to know what the issues are, but it is a total another thing for us to actually be actively involved in order to make these very necessary changes that I hear you talking about today.
Yeah, it's very important. I mean, it's an ongoing issue of taxation without representation. And appreciate your concern about the lack of representation here in D.C. So in broad terms, how is your organization Life After Release challenging the conviction system? You talk about a prison abolition, prosecutor accountability. If you could touch on that.
Yes. And so the ways that we're doing it is through the lens of prosecutorial accountability. You heard Charles talk about the ways in which different charges are prosecuted in Washington, D.C. But the prosecution of prosecution in general is something that we should be looking at. It is something that our organization has been looking at in D.C. in Prince George's County for a very long time. It is the work of Life After Release and the current state's attorney, Aisha Braveboy, who is the most progressive prosecutor in that position, and has put together a lot of parameters that will lessen and reduce the imprint of incarceration in the county. And one of those prosecutorial tools that she used in talking to community members and understanding the need for what is known as a CIU, or Conviction Integrity Unit, and their office has overseen over 400 applications to be able to look at the conviction integrity of cases over the years of people who have been incarcerated for a number of years and being able to bring them home. And so that's the type of work that we're doing when we say that here at Life After Release, we are focusing in on prosecutorial accountability. And that being said, we do have an upcoming prosecutor race that is going to be very important, that the community starts to understand and understand what that office does, and understand that when they go to the voting booth to vote for someone, that we need someone in that position that would have and continue to create programming that would allow for alternative sentencing, that would allow for conviction integrity, that would allow for us to reduce our imprint on mass incarceration, not only by bringing individuals home from incarceration that's been there for a period of time, but to reduce individuals from going into the system.
It's very important. And how is Life After Release helping formerly incarcerated persons get what they need to succeed? I mean, it must be, you know, you had some education prior to your incarceration, but a lot of folks that get put in jail don't. I mean, how are you helping folks deal with the life after being released?
Yeah, my heart is still full. Give you an example. This weekend we had a technology expo that was talking about how the ways in which technology is impacting the lives of those who are returning. And that expo, we were able in District 7, we were able to impact the lives of so many. We gave away free professional headshots. We gave away individuals that were having interviews. We were able to get them mini makeovers. One gentleman just called me and told me he got a job offer today. And today is what? Tuesday. And we had that event on Saturday. And so we are impacting and we are out in community and bringing impacted people into the fold. Whether that's how to do technology, how to navigate parole and probation, how to get an expungement so that you can have a better quality of life. We are at the intersections of all the things that impact individuals' lives post-conviction. And so just to talk a little bit about our technology expo, that was a huge success. We were able to give away laptops and headphones and webcams. Wow. And different things that you know, the average returning citizen probably would not have access to, and that people don't think about is an issue. A lot of our individuals who are impacted were left behind at the start of COVID when we started going online for everything.
Yeah, I mean, it's terribly important. It's so important to support people that are struggling and want to have a viable income, viable housing, and need the resources that you all are providing. If you could touch on expungement, I mean, it must be very difficult. I mean, what Maryland and DC, I don't know about either jurisdiction, but I mean, it takes a while to get your criminal record expunged. I mean, if you could talk about that, it must be a serious impediment to getting employment.
It is a very, very serious, not only to get an employment, but to the quality of your life. Even getting housing is impacted by your your background. And so DC does, they don't do, because again, DC is not a state. So DC does not engage in expungement. They do record sealing. But in Maryland, we're very active in Maryland, increasing their expungement opportunities. We have been able to help our community through a program called Participatory Defense, as I told you before, and we are able to help them get expungements or go back to the court through a motion to ask the judge to reduce their conviction from a felony to a misdemeanor. I mean, a judge has that power. We were talking about judges earlier. Judges have a lot of power. Judges and prosecutors have a lot of power locally, and so tapping into some of those powers, and maybe it may not be an expungement. We may have to go another route. But one thing we live on here at Life After Release is that when we fight and when we show up, we win. And so we have been very successful in our monthly expungement clinic that we have. So if you're looking for us, you can find us on social media. If you would like to sign up for that, Life After Release, you can find us, and we have monthly, one is coming up this Saturday at our office. We're having a monthly expungement clinic, and it's been going very, very well.
It's very, very important. And you see yourselves with your organization, Life After Release, as a part of a national movement. If you could touch on that and what you think the impact of the current presidential administration is having on that movement.
Yeah, we are a part of several different national movements, and we are in a very particular time right now. And the only thing that I can suggest is that no one can afford to sit at home. We all have to engage in a form of mutual aid. Everything that we're doing is going to be vital to our existence and being able to survive. And it's more than just a nonprofit adventure. It is actually a way of life. And so we should be connecting neighbors, helping neighbors block by block to be able to impact communities in ways that we wouldn't have thought before. We're going to have to really help our neighbors to do things to get, you know, to be able to succeed and survive.
Yeah, I mean, it's, there's so many, you know, as is often spoken about, I mean, you know, Trump is kind of flooding the field. I mean, there's so many, and it's intentional. There's so many expressions of what many are calling authoritarianism, and Lord knows, you know, that formerly incarcerated people are subjected to a disproportionate amount of abuse from Trump and from the general community. I mean, it's almost a blessing that you were incarcerated. You've got a life mission ahead of you.
Yeah, I think about that. I don't know if it's a blessing or a curse. I'm a go-to for a lot of people's homes. I got a call yesterday from a gentleman, from a mother whose son is in community, and you know, he got into an incident at the metro station and was being held. And she called me on a Sunday to go to court, emergency court hearing for her son on Monday morning. And, you know, that's what I say when I say, you know, mutual aid. I want to focus less on the administration and more of the people. It's more of us than it is really of them. And so I feel like if we put our energy into focusing on ways to build up rather than the constant tearing down of things, I feel like we will get a little bit further in our endeavors.
Yeah, we're going to have to end it there. Thank you so much for all you do and for joining us today. I've been speaking with Kiana Johnson, founder of Life After Release. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me.
Appreciate it. And thanks to the amazing Mike for his engineering expertise. Coming up, we've got the WPFW news headlines, followed by Don't Forget the Blues with the absolutely extraordinary Lady Murr. Thank you for listening. Have a good week. I'm Dave Rabin.
WPFW has been a site of resistance in defense of truth, justice, and culture for 48 years. Our spring membership drive begins with a special celebration of James Brown's birthday, May 3rd, and closes with a centennial birthday celebration of Malcolm X on May 19th. Two pillars of music and message. Your financial sustenance is needed more than ever to continue this type of programming. As a new listener or current member, this is your opportunity to contribute to the growth of an institution that stands resolute against both gross injustice and repression and the mass erasure of history and culture by amplifying the voices of scholars, artists, and activists whose work centers the humanity of all people. That's 48 years of being a site of resistance in defense of truth, justice, and culture, May 3rd through the 19th. WPFW works daily to build the world we want to inhabit by building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
WPFW commemorates the birthday of James Joseph Brown on May 3rd from 7 a.m. to midnight. Revolution of the Mind, Unpacking the Genius and Torment of James Brown, will feature his music, delve into his complicated and tumultuous family history and sometimes troubling behavior, and celebrate his artistic, entrepreneurial, and activist legacy, including James's live performances in Ghana, Zambia, and Zaire, present-day DRC. That's Revolution of the Mind, Unpacking the Genius and Torment of James Brown, Saturday, May 3rd, 7 a.m. to midnight on WPFW, Building a Better World, one broadcast at a time. Full schedule found on WPFWFM.org.
In commemoration of International Jazz Day, Friends of the Congo, Africa World Now Project, WPFW, and the Institute of Musical Traditions presents an evening examining jazz, espionage, and colonialism in Africa, with a free screening of Soundtrack to a Coup d'Etat on Wednesday, April 30, 6:30 p.m. at Seekers Church, 276 Carroll Street Northwest, steps away from the Tacoma Park Metro. The evening concludes with a panel discussion. Seating is limited, so registration is required. Details at Eventbrite and then searching Friends of the Congo. WPFW, Building a Better World, one broadcast at a time.
My Body, My Festival 2025, DC's only abortion access music festival, is coming May 16th and 17th. Presented by the DC Abortion Fund and Burger Sounds, My Body, My Festival will take place at the Black Cat and Union Stage, featuring local artists across genres, including Alex Vaughn, Carly Harvey, Sicily, Taisha Estrada, B. Steadwell, Zoe Jorgensen, and more. My Body, My Festival is a celebration of our city and ensuring abortion care is available to all who need it. Details at mybodymyfestival.com.
We're gonna make reparations rise. Agitate, educate, organize. How we gonna make reparations rise? National Reparations Rally, Saturday, May 17th, a festival of unity and celebration of the ongoing quest for reparations, as well as the 100th anniversary of the birth of Malcolm X. Speakers include Michael Eric Dyson, Robin Ruth Simmons, O'Malley Yeshitela, Ajua Ayatoro, with virtual remarks from Marilana Karenga, actress Erica Alexander, and Ben Chavis. Performance include the rapper Raz Kaz, along with DC's own Ayanna Gregory, Afi Soul, Lucy Murphy, Nana Malaya, and the Malcolm X dancers and drummers, Free Benjamin, Randy Payton, and Laini Mataka. May 17th, Landsberg Park, 1098 Delaware Avenue Southwest, 11 a.m.